What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks. Hundreds of masked white nationalists marched on the Capitol on July 4th, which was the 250th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. Joining us to discuss is Mike German, an expert on national security, domestic terrorism, and intelligence oversight. He's a former FBI special agent, the author of several books, including his latest, Policing White Supremacy, The Enemy Within, and my favorite FBI former agent. I mean, you never thought that I would have liked one. But
Well, thank you for that. I appreciate it.
Mike German and I first started talking, I was still host of Upfront when the label Black Identity Extremist came out, and I realized they were talking about me and people like me. Mike, let's get into it. I'm actually surprised we haven't talked more, given all of the activity, thanks to the person.
Yeah, unfortunately, there will be more opportunities down the road, I'm afraid. Yeah,
so we're going to use your, what do you call that? Crystal ball. Your informed crystal ball a little bit later, but I want to talk about who these guys were, are. The group of men are said to be from the Patriot Front. I actually want to start with what we may know about their founder, Thomas Rousseau.
People, I think, first became alarmed about Thomas Rousseau and the Patriot Front at the 2017 Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia. He was then in an organization called Vanguard America, which you may have, people may remember the men in white polo shirts and khaki pants with shields. That was the group that Alex Fields, the driver who murdered Heather Heyer, was part of during the march. So clearly a group that had significant menace associated with it. What happens with these white supremacist groups very often is that they will, when they receive some kind of bad reporting, you know, bad news, they are engaged in a violent incident, they'll change their name and appearance to try to avoid that association. So the group somewhat split up, and Thomas Rousseau took a group that he renamed Patriot Front, and now they wear blue polo shirts and khakis, and now they mask because they're aware that their public demonstrations can often lead to charges down the road. They've been growing all across the country. There have been a number of arrests involving their activities. Their above ground activities tend to be mostly propaganda, but they'll end up getting charged with vandalism for the graffiti and stickers that they put out promoting white supremacists and white nationalists propaganda, and have been involved in violence where these provocative actions, like on the National Mall on July 4th, where they come in mass, masked in, you know, essentially uniforms, and march, they tend to provoke some response, and that response often allows them to commit violence against any counter protesters. So that is a tactic that comes straight out of 1920s and 1930s Nazi Party mobilizations, where they would intentionally target audiences and localities where they knew they were unpopular for these demonstrations, hoping to draw out some resistance to what they were saying so that they could then attack those groups. So this is a very old methodology that's being reused. And you know, the show of force of bringing 400 people to Washington, D.C., the logistics and money involved in that, I think highlights that this is a group that law enforcement needs to keep an eye on. Unfortunately, what we see is law enforcement often enables their activities.
You knew where I was going to go, because you and I have talked about the connection between the military and these white supremacist groups and law enforcement and these white supremacist groups, and often folks being members of both at federal level as well, which you are an expert at. I'm assuming all of those connections remain in place as these groups continue to grow.
And are even stronger. One, because the FBI and other law enforcement agencies are not engaged in enforcement actions against these groups as regularly as they had been, which still was insufficient to the nature of the threat. But more importantly, because the political establishment with the Trump administration is very supportive of these actions. So, people tend to look at groups like Patriot Front and think of them as extremist groups. These are groups on the fringes of our society, and liken them to other ideologies that are very fringe. But what I've learned over 30 years of looking at this is it's really more mainstream. White supremacy, white nationalism, Christian nationalism is much more mainstream than we want to acknowledge. And it's not just the police and the military where the people holding these ideologies and these opinions are present, but in the judiciary, in government writ large. And now we see sympathetic statements being made by the top leaders of our country and supported in the courts and supported in Congress. So, many of the activities that we, the extreme activities we see ICE engaging in on the immigration front, while at the same time, the State Department is about to host an international meeting to look at what they call left-wing terrorism. And trying to basically manufacture a threat out of their political opposition rather than looking at who actually persistently kills people in this country. And that predominantly is white nationalists and white supremacists.
Mike German, if you were going to compare and contrast, like in terms of danger to melanated bodies or queer bodies, let's say, I don't know, when Jim Crow was in full effect and black bodies were still swinging from trees in the South and the North, I might add, to today, what would you say in terms of threat level, either that exists now and or where we're headed?
It's hard to compare eras like that. One, because the reporting on that era was insufficient. There were some intrepid reporters who would report on those lynching incidents, but even today, 100 years later, it's hard for historians to go back and get an accurate count of the number. So I don't know if I can make an apt comparison, but that is certainly and explicitly where this administration wants to go, right? They've said it out loud that the assaults on diversity, equity, and inclusion, the assaults on black military leaders and female military leaders, they're trying to reestablish the white social order that existed back then, where white people had preference and people of color and women were at risk. Other activities like the Justice Department's indictment of the Southern Poverty Law Center, which monitors white supremacist groups, targeting the anti-ICE protesters in Minneapolis with criminal prosecutions. These are very much harkened back to that Jim Crow era where the tools of law enforcement were not being used for public safety, but to enforce the white dominant social order.
Thank you. I think it's really important for folks to sit in the actual dangers of what's happening. And so when I'm talking about lynchings right then, I'm talking about literal assaults, physical assaults on melanated bodies. Now, and not for nothing, there is a smattering of young black bodies that have been found swinging from trees on college campuses, in communities in Florida. Like, it's happening. It is
And
happening.
not only that, half of the murders, roughly half of the murders in the United States go unsolved. So it's fascinating to me when we built this machinery of national security and public statement that devotes more resources to policing in most cities and states rather than social services for their residents, and yet, with all the technology they have, all the new tools that our internet culture has given law enforcement to track people, they're solving less violent crime, and I think that's because that's not where their priorities are. So we don't know who's killing half the people in the United States, and you know, we do know that Black and Brown people are disproportionately victims of violent crime. I'm sure if we knew exactly how many people were being killed by people who had some sort of white supremacist sympathy, whether they're, you know, some skinhead on the street or whether they're a police officer or an ICE agent, I think we'd see these numbers rise significantly.
Wherein lies the attraction for white folks to these groups in this moment? What is the promise that they think is being fulfilled or will be fulfilled by these groups?
That's a great question, Kat, and I think that's what frustrates me more than anything. It's that they have been, that the media culture that exists, the social media culture, and even the media culture, you know, cable news, promotes a myth of what they call the replacement theory or white genocide. You know, this constant reinforcement that white Christian people are being victimized in the United States, and what is rightfully theirs is being taken away and given to others, whether those others are new immigrants or whether those others are people of color or women, and that it's their right to reclaim that dominance over society, much the way after Reconstruction, you know, again, going back to that Jim Crow era, you know, we had that period of effort to make sure that we were taking the former enslaved and allowing them to participate in our democracy. And then the white redeemers came in and took all that back, using not just illegal violence and extrajudicial violence, but official violence, police violence, you know, the use of poll taxes to prevent voting. And you know, my concern is, as we come up to another election, that is often when you see this kind of violence rise. And you know, obviously the elections have been hot points of political rhetoric, you know, amplified political rhetoric in the last few years, and with the FBI involved in these bogus voter fraud investigations and social media promoting them, I think we're headed into a period where it's going to be dangerous, and that's part of the goal. Is to make sure that people are fearful about going to the polls, that not only you might meet some criminal who's engaged in violence, but you might end up charged with a crime for some reason for simply going down and trying to vote.
We have just a couple of minutes left. Mike German, we heard nothing from Trump, no surprise there. The administration talked about the importance of free speech, and then it's protected. And that's what we hear, right? Every time, like, people have a right to free speech. When it comes to these kinds of actions, and of course, like, our side's the track, we say that too. We have the right to say what we want to say, right? I can say FTP all I want to. That said, a lot of times when these groups come to town and they spew their venom, there's actual physical material consequences for melanated people in their wake. So I remember when Richard Spencer was, you know, going all over the place, and there's ignited this conversation about free speech because he was going to college campuses. And so I'll just use Berkeley. Like, when he came here, there was LGBTQ plus shops that were targeted, spray painted, windows broken. There were folks that were verbally assaulted on the streets, physically assaulted on the streets for being Black, Brown, and or queer. How do you hold the both? This is a big question. I'm gonna ask you to answer in like 2 minutes. But how do you hold the both of those realities, right? Because if we go after their right to say what they say, right, they're definitely coming for us.
Right.
But also, like, what is the responsibility of government to protect vulnerable groups when folks like this come to town if we're gonna let them talk?
So free speech doesn't mean that everybody has to give them a platform, right? And it doesn't free them from the consequences of their speech being ostracized from society. That isn't part of the First Amendment. The First Amendment restricts government action against speech. And as a former law enforcement agency, I have focused on what law enforcement should do. And in my book, Policing White Supremacy, I talk about how they have to understand the tactics of these white supremacist groups, that they intentionally go to places where they know they're going to meet counter protesters so that they can provoke violence, coming prepared to commit violence. We were talking about the Patriot or Patriot Front. They work closely with these active groups, which are white supremacist groups that train in fight in boxing and martial arts to be prepared for those kinds of confrontations. So, it's really, unfortunately, that role relies on law enforcement doing its job, which is where we have seen failures, such as in Berkeley, and the people who lead those groups unfortunately become celebrities within the movement for the violence that they have committed.
And I'll just say real, I'll say here because it wasn't Berkeley PD or the city of Berkeley that protected anybody. It was Terha Ak and T folks that identified, right. We're all and that was the time of we're all Antifa, right? It was the
Right.
people that actually
Right.
ran them up out of there.
Exactly. And it's up to us to protect ourselves and to understand who these groups are and know when they're coming to our communities so our communities can be informed about how best to protect themselves.
I have one more question because I have to because it's not just spreading across the United States. There's a global uptick in white supremacist organizations and movements. And can you just briefly talk about the connection between the global groups and the local, and by local, I mean
Right.
nationwide groups?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting that the FBI designates Nazis and other white supremacists as domestic terrorists, but we didn't invent Nazis, right? That was a movement that began in Europe, and it's always been an international movement. And that's one aspect that the federal government has really fallen down on, is that they don't recognize how tied they're in, not just in across the violent groups throughout the Europe and South Africa and Australia, but in the far right elements of the government, right? In many places there are overtly white supremacist parties. And I think that's why you don't see the same kind of crackdown on material support for foreign terrorism in the white supremacist cult category. And it's because that would affect political groups abroad that the many in the United States support or rely on.
Mike German, as you mentioned, we're going to have more opportunities to speak in the future.
Anytime.
The Alameda County Board of Supervisors approved to extend their contract with the surveillance network Flock. Here to discuss is George Galvez, co-founder and executive director of Communities United for Restorative Youth Justice, or Courage. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Sister Kat. Thank you for having me on.
Thanks for joining us so early. I appreciate it. $2.3 million to extend Flock contract, which includes automated license plate readers, which captures data from the backs of passing vehicles, pan tilt zoom cameras that give operators with a real-time view of public areas, and a fleet of drones. Your immediate concerns, George, about the ongoing and ever increasing surveillance of our communities in this political moment.
Yeah, so the rise of the surveillance is really inextricably linked to the rise of authoritarianism, right? We can't necessarily separate those two. And we can't necessarily make a distinction between even our partisan politics. Like at this point, you know, both parties are endorsing and supporting fascism. One is maybe presenting a friendlier, a kinder, gentler form of fascism is what they're trying to present as a way of trying to kind of put wool over our eyes. But bottom line is once these rights, once this privacy is invaded, it's going to be extremely, extremely difficult to try to roll any of these things back. And so we have to also think about how this is inextricably linked to sort of the rise of artificial intelligence, data centers, the ways that data centers are going to be devastating our communities by consuming all of our drinking water, something that's essential for life. Like all of these things are inextricably linked. We cannot talk about these things separately. And we already know, like, there's a reason why people say, get the flock out of here. You know what I'm saying? Get the flock out of Oakland, because they're sharing data with ICE. They're sharing data with all these other agencies. We also know that law enforcement has used flock data to stalk women. And this isn't just like one isolated incident. Incident after incident, we know that law enforcement has become a magnet for misogynistic, racist, problematic, abusive men who know that they can operate with impunity. And so this has become an epidemic. So how our information is being used has nothing to do with public safety and everything to do with social control and repression and authoritarianism.
The Sheriff's Department will also have access to something called Nova, which is a software that lets them centralize data from computer-aided dispatch and record management systems, and then access open-source intelligent data. Basically, it's a very fancy way for them to get the data, arrange the data, and target their person. You and I have spent decades fighting the Sheriff's Department. We're promised right. Change with the new sheriff, Yesenia. What instead has been the reality in terms of community abuses by the Sheriff's Department, including killings? I mean, recently, I'm just going to lift up Anthony Ant, who was a young musician who was murdered in February of this year. What kind of Sheriff's Department do we have that now has more flock and more expanded software for surveillance?
Yeah, the truth is nothing's really changed since the transition from Sheriff Ahern. We knew Ahern was a white supremacist, MAGA, Trump supporter. You know, Yolanda ran once again to be a kinder, gentler fascist of some sort, you know, kind of similar to other patterns we've been seeing in our political landscape. So now we just basically have Ahern and Brownface. You know what I mean? And so, you know, the same, right? If I'm lying, I'm dying, Kat. You feel me?
I love
so,
it.
You know, it's Ahern and Brownface. You know what I mean? It looks good in terms of, you know, DEI demographics. Oh, we got a woman sheriff. We got a Latina sheriff. You know what I mean? She uses language. She's more politically astute than Sheriff Ahern, perhaps, in terms of saying, oh, yeah, we don't want to cooperate with ICE. We're not going to do that. But then her practices are fundamentally different. There has really been no substantive change in policies and practices since the transition from Ahern. So, you know, we're also, I think, to be quite frank, putting our city, our county, our local municipal governments in a vulnerable position to being sued. You know what I mean? And like you and I, we're kind of like in this precarious situation because we advocate a lot for families who've been impacted by police and state violence, right? And oftentimes the only form of well, let's just say, I wouldn't say it's really a form of justice, but the only thing that they can really pursue is civil litigation. You know what I mean? But at the same time, we also know that where those civil lawsuits are coming from ain't from the police budget. It's right. Coming out of the general pot. And that general pot is generally being used for other things that could be used for vulnerable services for folks, senior services, childcare, you know, so many other things that we know actually promote and support authentic community-based safety strategies. And so, you know, those are the things that get cut from. So, you know, all of this stuff with flock is making us vulnerable to lawsuits. You know, the database access concerns are absolutely not just, they're not just concerns. They're actually like, it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when, and it's already happening. You know, the abuse of our privacy is happening in real time. They're sharing our data with ICE and other federal agencies. They're using people's data to stalk a woman that they once saw in a Facebook photo, and now they're trying to ask her out on a date by pulling her over at a traffic stop type of weird stuff going on. I mean, it's just, it's weird ass stuff going on, and nobody's blinking an eye, man. It's absolutely crazy. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, we call ourselves a sanctuary city. Let's just call it what it really is. It's BS. It's hypocrisy. And any elected official that says that they're voting to make us a sanctuary city that is standing up against ICE and against Customs and Border Patrol and then simultaneously votes in support of Flock is a lying hypocrite.
That would be almost every single person on the Oakland City Council.
That's where we at right
on
now.
On the Board of Supervisors, with the exception of Nikki Bass and what's the other woman's name? Oh, I can't think of it right now. I'm gonna give her credit though in a minute.
Yeah.
But who did vote for it though is Supervisor David Hobart of District 1, who is a member of the United States Army. His district includes Dublin, where the jail is at, in Livermore, most of Fremont, the unincorporated community of Sunol, a portion of the city of Pleasanton, and most of the unincorporated area of Livermore-Amador Valley. He said, quote, "These cameras are meant to keep us safe. I don't believe they are widely used by ICE. Has it been that it's happened? I don't think it's widely used by the federal government. I don't think it's used to surveil people." What kind of nonsensical statement? What do you mean it's not meant to surveil people? It's literally cameras taking pictures of people. What is wrong with him?
It's literally about surveillance. That's exactly what it does. You know what I mean? And, you know, and we can't deny that this is all inextricably linked also to how we're seeing the rise of AIPAC and Israeli influence in the United States. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, the Israeli occupational forces have been training law enforcement. You know, we see that we have our own version of a cop city here in the Bay Area in the city of San Pablo. And the purpose of that is really to serve as a data center for law enforcement to surveil. And what they're most concerned about surveilling isn't necessarily about crime, to be quite frank. It's really surveilling activism. So this is about political repression and suppression. That's what it's about more than anything. People who are peacefully protesting, standing up against the rise of authoritarianism, are being deemed domestic terrorists. You know, we've seen in Texas most recently, people who've been arrested, who have been given life sentences, 30 years for what? For moving a box of zines, something that is constitutionally protected, you know, activity, is being criminalized under this administration. But don't think that that's just going to be happening in Texas. This is already creeping into California. California is the headquarters for the broligarchy and all these tech bros who are supporting and endorsing this activity, who are profiting from all of this activity and surveillance too, through their AI investments. So we can't just think about this in a vacuum. We have to think about how these things are inextricably linked. It's not even about a multi-million dollar contract, because in the bigger scheme of things, that's not a lot. It's cumulatively how that adds up to promote these AI venture capitalists, and how it shows that yet they're already going to be out there in the NASDAQ, and they're going to be used as if they're making a profit, right? There used to be a criteria that you had to profit a certain amount before they could be, you know, before they could invest your 401k funds into it. They're already doing that for folks like Elon Musk, for things like SpaceX that have yet to turn a damn profit. Like, the rules are being reinvented and changed, right? Even capitalism, you know, to support these tech bros and the broligarchy, the authoritarianism, and everything, all the way down to what's happening on a micro level in the city of Oakland with Flock and the hyper surveillance of our people. And let's be real, they ain't out there surveilling what's going on in the hills. They're not surveilling what's happening with our most affluent residents. This is absolutely targeting Black and brown working class people. And also, it's targeting activism more than anything else.
The Board of Supervisors person that I needed to also say voted against the extension is Elisa Marquez. However, she did say that she's not against, she believes we need the technology. She just wants a different, nicer way to track.
Yeah, kinder, gentler type of fascism, which frankly, we got to really start pushing back on this sort of narrative. You know what I mean? This duopoly that we have to operate on. how can we actually draw on some of the energy that we've seen in New York with Zemdani? You know what I mean? You know, Zemdani ran on really investing in community-based safety strategies and creating, and what he's been able to do is crime is at an all-time low in New York City. And it's not because they hired more cops and more police. It's not because they put more money into Rikers Jail. You know what I mean? It's because they've actually invested in the safety net and addressing root causes. You know what I'm saying? We've always said, Kat, you and I have always told people the safest communities ain't got the most police and jails. They got the most resources, right? And that's what he's been able to prove in New York City. It's a model. And that's the kind of energy we need here in the Bay. It's disappointing that Oakland, the birthplace of the Panther Party, what many people continue to kind of see as a headquarters for progressive politics, you know, is, you know, frankly, not reflective of those values in our city council and our local government at this time.
Right. All right, George, in my last couple of minutes with you, I want to turn attention now to the police shooting by the Oakland Police Department on Monday of this week. This is the third shooting this year. The last person that OPD murdered in 2015 was Richard Perkins in Deep East Oakland. From 2015 to 2026, there were three shootings in total. We have now had three shootings just this year. What do we know about what happened? Your concerns about the uptick?
Yeah. Oh my goodness. Where did it begin? Well, let's just say that it's not an uncanny correlation with the fact that just as Oakland Police, which has been under federal oversight for decades, and is finally, you know, scheduled to be released from federal oversight, and all of a sudden we see a rise in these homicides. You know what I mean? Rise in this activity, you know. So what we know is James Beard was an unhoused man. He was murdered in cold blood. You know, some of my courage team was actually on the ground when it happened. You know, but they blocked off all the streets and prevented anybody from being able to access it, which is interesting because technically, you know, my staff were actually contracted by Department of Violence Prevention to be out there when homicides occur, when gun violence occurs, right? But we're only there to de-escalate when it's fratricidal. So when police murder our people, all of a sudden, you know, we're blocked from being able to actually go and engage with the people who are impacted, the loved ones of James Beard, to see how they're affected and what kind of support services and trauma-informed care that they might actually need after witnessing the bloody, sorry is what I said. I'm so flocking, sorry. Yeah, I'm sorry, James Beard, we still don't know the name of the unhoused person, man. I'm sorry, it's early for me, Kat, and I just got back from South Dakota from ceremony, so my brain's a little
I
foggy.
Love you, it's good,
but yeah,
it's good.
But the new chief of police is James Beard, thank you, and we had an unhoused man who is still unnamed, who was murdered in cold blood, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, Chief Beard said that he was armed with a dangerous weapon. Well, if he was armed with a dangerous weapon, if you know damn well if he had a gun or a knife, they would have said that.
No, so it was a bladed object. A bladed object.
So what the heck does that mean? That could mean anything. That could mean absolutely anything. That could be a damn backpack, and they could say that that's a weapon. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. They are trying to rationalize the irrational, defend the indefensible. You know what I'm saying? And all they said is that they were responding to an incident at a homeless encampment. But what we've been seeing is this increased criminalization of poverty, this increased crackdown on houseless people. You know, we've also simultaneously seen a crackdown and criminalization of street vendors, right? We've witnessed them. Like, just the same day we marched for immigrant rights, immigrant workers on May Day, immediately after the march ended with Oakland Sin Fronteras, I'm driving up the street on Fruitvale, and what do I see? I see dozens of law enforcement agencies representing multiple jurisdictions.
Yep.
County, city, Department of, you know, the public, were all these different agencies, and they had a big old garbage truck, and what were they doing? They were basically stealing all of the property of a small vendor, a small, you know, business owner who had their business set up on the corner, and they were throwing all that stuff in the trash. Like, even if you're like out there, like, first of all, it's not criminal to actually have a business without a permit. and you can give someone a citation, you know what I mean? And frankly, there should be programs to how we actually make those things accessible. Because if you've ever had to try to navigate the county department of public health, you know, or anything for that matter, a grant from the city or county, like, you know, the procurement process and the bureaucracy is real. You know what I mean? Right. And then imagine being a person who has limited English speaking, trying to navigate that when you're just trying to operate a micro enterprise to survive. So can we actually invest in programs that allow people to be able to do this with their licenses and permits that are required, you know what I mean? And make it more accessible. But instead, what they're actually doing is they're taking all their property, the investment, you know, thousands of dollars for people who are already just trying to get by, and they're throwing it in the trash and just vandalizing it. How is the destruction of property and these businesses not a crime? You know what I'm saying? But yet here we are, we protect multinational corporations and capitalism all the time, all day. So I say that much to say that that crackdown of street vendors is no different, and we cannot separate that either than the crackdown on houseless people and the murder that we just seen of an unnamed man, and the way that it's being rationalized, you know, and the new apologist in chief, James Beard.
Oh, I mean, it was like, oh yeah, you really are a veteran, because this is the same tape you've been running on our people every time you've murdered someone for the last 20 years. I've been on the ground doing the work here. George, I gotta move on to our next guest. I will see you Friday morning. I'm about to tell the people where. Thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you so much. And yeah, get the flock out of Oakland, right?
Block out of Oakland and Alameda County. Yeah. Y'all, we've been talking to George Galvitz, co-founder and executive director of Communities United for Restorative Youth Justice, or Courage.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard, or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.